Our next case is First Niagara v. First Niagara. The other is a financial group.
My name is George Gottlieb, counsel for appellant, First Niagara Insurance Brokers. The opposer below, excuse me, and the appellant here is a Canadian insurance broker. It's located only in Canada. Its office is in Canada, its bank accounts are in Canada, its real estate is in Canada. But we contend that that is not the test to determine whether it has rendered services which, pursuant to the Lanham Act, give it a protectable service mark.
What specifically have you done in interstate commerce in the United States? Your best, we've read the briefs, so we know your allegations, but what's your best case?
May I also address that to foreign commerce, but that's also a test. We have insured a company called Stewart's Deliveries, which is a Canadian trucker who takes goods, commodities from Canada, drives them through 8 states. So we have placed insurance for him. If he had an accident on the New York State Thruway, we handled and facilitated the resolution of that claim.
Wouldn't you just insure your party?
Yes.
So in other words, all of your transaction would occur in Canada?
No, because
if he injures someone else, he will pay them, right? You will pay your client and your client will pay the injured party?
No. For example, one of his trucks hit something on the New York State Thruway. The Thruway made a claim against the insured. And the insurance company, which wrote this insurance, paid New York State. And that was facilitated by our client, who acted as an intermediary to help resolve the claim.
What does that mean? What do you mean facilitated?
Well,
he doesn't pay the money, right?
No, if there's a dispute between the insurance company and the person who's injured, let's say there was a dispute about how much the damages were, and that had to be resolved.
Or who's liable? What role does your client play?
It brings the two parties together.
What does that mean?
The insurance company and the party who's been damaged.
The Canadian insurance company.
Correct. And the U.S. entity whose property has been damaged.
Right.
Or let's say there was a...
So does your client deal with the... Let's assume it's an American citizen who's been injured,
right,
by something the Canadian company has,
yes,
done in the United States.
Yes, we definitely
does
deal...
Does his lawyer deal with you? Are you the representatives,
yes,
of the insurance,
exactly,
company?
Exactly right. There is in the record, for example, we insure someone called Rainbow Travel, a Canadian travel agency that arranges for travel trips between the United States and Canada. One of the passengers, a U.S. resident, was injured. Their lawyer wrote to our client making a claim because of the injury.
Okay, but what was your role?
Well, we then contacted the insurance company and filled
out... You contacted your client insurance company,
right,
or the other person?
Our client...
So you're dealing with your Canadian insurance,
right,
company.
That's correct.
Right? What were your dealings, what are the extent of your dealings with anyone on the other end of that in the United States?
Well, we corresponded with the lawyers who made the claim. We put the two into contact together.
Yep.
The lawyers for the injured party, the U.S. lawyers for the injured party...
What if you put in contact and you say, if you have a claim, you should refer it to gentleman X sitting at an office in Ontario that works for the insurance company? Is,
right,
that the extent of your,
that's correct,
involvement?
And if there's a problem resolving that, our client gets involved, like any insurance broker does, in helping resolve the problem. In other words, if an insurance company wants more documentation, or if the insurance company wants an estimate, and let's say there's a car that's located in the United States that wasn't an accident, we might be asked to get a repair estimate from a garage in the United States. All of these administrative details, this is what every brokerage agency does, helps facilitate.
And the test here is whether or not your client is engaged in activities that are potentially regulatable, that's a word, by Congress.
Exactly
correct?
Right.
What are the activities there that are potentially regulatable?
Congress could say for every Canadian car that comes into the United States, we, Congress, demand that that be insured by a United States insurance company and by a United States broker. In other words, Congress has an absolute right to control, in any way it sees fit, all transportation of goods and
but
people.
That means Congress is regulating the American businesses. But by your definition, if that act of Congress would be putting your client in foreign commerce, then that means everyone in Canada is automatically in foreign commerce. Everybody in the world is automatically in foreign commerce because the Congress could arguably say nobody in America can deal with anybody on the outside. Does just that potential make everything else in the universe engaged in foreign commerce?
Well, Congress had said, Your Honor, that United States citizens going to Cuba can only buy a certain amount of goods. So Congress can regulate trucks running from Canada to the United States. And they can regulate travel services running between Canada and the United States. This is not any theoretical issue. This is commerce.
But let's say you deal with, you're a manufacturer of garments, women's clothes.
Right.
And so because Congress, in that situation, I guess you could arguably say that Congress could legislate and say that you can't bring those goods into the United States.
That means
that every single clothing dealer and manufacturer across the universe is also automatically engaged in foreign commerce because there's the potential there for Congress to regulate Americans so that there's an ultimate effect on everybody else in the universe?
I'm not going quite that far. I'm saying that those clothing manufacturers who actually bring clothes into the United States, that activity can be regulated by Congress. For example, Congress has statutes about labeling and foreign clothing coming into the United States.
There are duties that are charged on everything that comes in.
So that I'm saying all of this Canadian-U.S. activity can be regulated by Congress. And our client who gets insurance for this activity coming from Canada into the United States can also be regulated by Congress.
Don't you also have people in the United States who are coming to Canada who avail themselves of the services of your client?
Yes, certainly. And in the record, there are many U.S. Residents who have availed themselves of our services. For example, if a U.S. resident has a seasonal residence in Canada, they would contact our client, either directly or through a U.S. broker, and say, insure our seasonal dwelling in Canada. Now, let's say an accident happened at that Canadian home and the resident were in the United States. Well, then there would be correspondence if it was a payment of a check that would come from Canada to the United States.
So someone runs a restaurant in London and one American tourist who's in London eats at the restaurant and they make reservations at the restaurant while they're still in the United States. Is that restaurant in London engaged in foreign commerce?
Well, I would say that's really like the Mother's case, which is one of the cases that's been cited. I'm not sure that that would be regulated by Congress. But here there's a major difference, which is that the goods and vehicles are actually running from Canada to the United States.
No. I misunderstood. I thought Judge Clevenger was asking about the broker deal, where it's American citizens, but whatever they've insured is located in Canada.
And
I thought that's what we were talking about.
Okay. I mean, all of us travel, many of us take out travel insurance while we're in the United States.
But let's talk about when an American owns a home in Canada.
Okay.
And I thought that was one of the arguments that you had,
right,
because
yes.
Your client engages in this broker activities. So the property is in Canada. Why is that different than a restaurant in London? And why, if we say your client is engaged in foreign commerce, why is not that restaurant owner in London engaged in foreign commerce?
Because the difference is that, first of all, money transpires from the United States to Canada. When that United States resident pays an insurance bill, he's sending it to Canada. So there's a direct transaction.
What happens if you pay your hotel bill in London after you get back? You wire transfer the money to pay for the hotel bill.
Well, that's very much like the International Bancorp case, where if there's advertising that reaches the United States.
Let's say there's no advertising.
No advertising.
I'm going to London. I make a reservation at a restaurant there. When I get back, I didn't have any money with me. I didn't have my charge card. When I come back, I send the restaurant a check.
If the transaction takes place completely in London,
right.
In other words, you arrive in London, you make your reservation,
let's say I make my reservation from here. I make my reservation at this restaurant in London, and then when I come back, or I pay him there. I say, I don't want to take care of it there. Here's my money.
I think that is activities which could be regulated by Congress. Congress could control.
What are the activities? We're talking about the restaurant here. Right. Is that restaurant engaged in foreign commerce?
No, I don't think so.
Okay, then why is that different than your client with respect to the examples you were given, which is that he insures homes owned by American citizens but that are located in Canada?
Because if you go to London and have a meal there, essentially the service is rendered completely in the foreign country in London. You eat there and essentially you're finished. Here, there are continuous monetary transactions and paperwork transactions and telephone transactions.
Why? Only
because,
if there's a claim paid. So what if I go to the restaurant in London and I develop food poisoning? I mean, so there's a potential for some continuous contact after that.
Because there's a basic theoretical and conceptual difference between insurance services, which are continuous, which always involve transactions by telephone, by paperwork, by money going from one country to the other, which are not really characteristic of eating in a local restaurant in London. I think there's a very big difference there. In other words, in a transaction with a resident in Canada, there'll be insurance premiums paid from the United States to Canada. There'll be paperwork. There'll be telephone calls. There's a continuous activity which could be regulated by Congress. And in fact, Congress has regulated insurance in many, many instances.
Mr. Gottlieb, the board seemed to think that part of the problem here was that the activities that your client has that supposedly connect you up to interstate or foreign commerce were de minimis, merely incidental. I didn't quite understand what they meant by de minimis. Is there any evidence in the record about how much money is involved? I mean, for example, on an annual basis, how many dollars are involved in the part of trade that you contend is either interstate or foreign?
There's no direct evidence, but even that evidence would be very difficult to ascertain because, for example, I think our client insures about 900 automobiles. And all of those automobiles are covered when they come into the United States.
It may not be a dollar amount, some form of quantification, because I wasn't exactly sure where this de minimis notion came from. In Commerce Clause cases, just a dab will do you, typically from the point of view of whether the Congress has the authority to regulate, because they say that there could be potentially more than is involved in a particular case. But it would seem to me that if your client had only insured one person that ever drove in from Canada here, and you only had one person that had ever come and wanted to get their home in Canada insured, then a de minimis test might make sense?
Well, I think, Your Honor, de minimis and foreign commerce don't really work together, because I think Congress could regulate even one individual if it wanted to. But there's really nothing in the record which supports, this is something that the board below really found on its own. And it's really inconsistent with them saying this is a necessary part of your services. If it's a necessary part of our services to insure vehicles and goods coming into the United States, then de minimis doesn't make any sense. And the board also said that the services were incidental. And my argument is, incidental or not, if it's a service which is rendered in commerce, then it's something which enables us to get service market.
You wish to reserve a little of your rebuttal
yes.
time?
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Gottlieb. Mr. Perlman?
May it please the court, I'd like to directly address some of Mr. Gottlieb's arguments. It's important in this case to note that Mr. Gottlieb's client is not an insurance carrier. It's an insurance broker. All it does is broker the policies. And that makes a difference in terms of evaluating what the contacts are.
Our insurance, you have an insurance broker, don't you? Yeah,
sure.
I've got one too. Is your insurance broker engaged in interstate commerce in the United States?
In interstate commerce, I don't know if my particular
broker.
Wouldn't
you assume so? Doesn't your insurance broker get you policies from insurance companies that are in Connecticut, for example?
Well, it does.
Where's your the person that insures your automobile, your company, where are they located?
Beg pardon?
The company that writes your car insurance, not your broker, where are they located, domicile?
I deal with a company right in Buffalo, New York, a broker.
A broker, but I mean, don't brokers deal with companies that are in Delaware or New York, other places, the insurance companies themselves?
Sure they do.
Right.
Sure they do.
So that, wouldn't you just almost concede that almost any broker in the United States that has a heady, active business is engaged in interstate commerce?
They may be. Insurance is different from other businesses, however, because it's highly regulated. In order to be an insurance broker, you have to be licensed in
the
state.
But in this particular case, the board has said there's no unlawful activity here.
That's right. And we don't contend.
So that's off of the table.
That's right.
So the Canadian company, and we know the Canadian company has activity in the United States. The record is full of these letters they send to people about either the insurance that's being written to take care of the house in Canada or the insurance that's being taken care of for the Canadian car that comes in, right?
That's right.
And all that correspondence has got either their name or their trademark on it. Lots of that in the record. So those are all data points. Those are all touch points in the United States, right? So why doesn't that constitute engagement in commerce in the United States?
Because the way that the regulation works for insurance brokers is you have to be licensed in a particular area. And we took the testimony of First Niagara Canada's expert, insurance expert, and we asked him, look at all these data points that Your Honor is referring to. Is First Niagara Canada acting as an insurance broker in New York State? And his answer to that was no. That's at page 293 of the record, and that testimony was noted by the TTAB. The TTAB then went on to say that not only is First Niagara Canada not acting as an insurance broker in New York State, but it's not acting as an insurance broker anywhere in the United States.
So what? Can't they still be engaged in commerce even though they're not, quote, acting as a lawfully regulated broker?
Well, it's trying to register or trying to oppose marks on the basis that it's providing insurance brokerage services in the United States. We have a factual finding here by the TTAB, which is subject to the substantial evidence test, that says that they are not providing insurance brokerage services in the United States.
What about the point we discussed earlier about de minimis activity? Now, it's true that if I ship one product across a state line, that's sufficient to prove interstate commerce for trademark purposes. That might be considered de minimis. If one act that has anything to do with commerce is sufficient to reserve a mark under the Trademark Act, why are we discussing de minimis at all?
Well, I think we're discussing de minimis because the circuit courts that have decided the issue have said that in order to have trademark rights, you have to show not a de minimis effect on commerce, but a substantial effect on commerce. The Beauty case out of the Second Circuit, Beauty versus Perosa, said that and that was a case of an Italian restaurant, said that in order to have trademark rights, you have to show a substantial effect on commerce. In the Fourth Circuit in the Nintendo case, it's not cited in our brief, but it's 34 Fed 3rd 246, says there has to be a significant effect. What the TTAB was saying,
well,
I think
aren't,
what
those
were
cases
to
just
capture,
aren't those cases just flat wrong?
Pardon?
Those cases are flat wrong, aren't they? Doesn't the statute say that when you're talking about commerce for purposes of the Trademark Act, you're talking about the sweep of commerce to whatever the United States Congress could regulate?
Well,
are you telling me that the United States Congress can only regulate substantial interstate commerce?
Well,
yes or no?
For purposes of the trademark law, every circuit court that's looked at it has said that it has to be significant or substantial. But I think Your Honor's question can be answered by referring...
But a single act is sufficient to give me trademark registration. Well, so doesn't that cut in the direction that Judge Clevenger is talking about?
Well, I don't think when we're talking about foreign commerce, if you look at the beauty case and those from all the other circuits, they say a significant or substantial effect. But I think I can answer the question directly by referring to what we were talking about earlier. And that is, can the commerce be regulated by Congress? And again, the Second Circuit in the Beauty versus Perosa case said, and I think this follows up on one of Judge Prost's questions, you have to show that Congress can regulate the service, not the consumption or the use of that service. So the fact that an American may use that Canadian service to broker a policy for a Canadian residence really
you don't think the Congress could enact a statute that said it's a crime for a Canadian insurance brokerage to sell car insurance for somebody coming in the United States unless it meets certain limits?
I don't think Congress could regulate the activity of that Canadian company. Of course, if they came into the United States...
Just to take, I mean, let's assume there's a pattern of cases developed where people come in from Canada into, you know, upstate New York, drive their automobiles around, have terrible accidents, and it turns out that in Canada it's okay if you have $5,000 of liability insurance. That's all you have to have. And all these accidents produce damage well beyond that. And so the Congress says we've got to somehow stop those insurance companies up in Canada that are writing this $5,000 liability policy for all these Canadians to come down and hit all of our Americans. And so they say we'll go directly. Congress, you know, can make it a crime for foreigners to fix prices, to have a price-fixing conspiracy that exists offshore so long as it has an effect in America. That's the Timken case, right? So
right.
Congress say we're going to stop this by saying it'll be a federal offense for any Canadian broker to broker a policy that doesn't have a limit of whatever the state requirement is in New York?
Well, I don't think they could get jurisdiction over the Canadian broker.
That's what extradition is for.
Well,
you know, that's why you have relations with, you know, some countries will send people back to the United States when we say they violate our laws, some countries won't.
I mean, they certainly can regulate the consumption. They can say cars can't come in here.
I'm saying they regulate. Why can't they regulate the broker?
I don't think they could regulate the broker because all the cases that talk about that talk about substantial effect.
Is there a difference between foreign commerce and interstate commerce in this context? The amount of commerce that has to be regulated before it is regulatable?
I think foreign commerce has to be substantial. Some of the cases that have talked about interstate commerce obviously put a lower threshold on that. Foreign commerce cases, Beauty, Nintendo, Reebok out of the Ninth Circuit, an International Cafe out of the 11th Circuit, for example.
But isn't it regulatable even if it's only a single act?
I don't believe the foreign commerce is because of all those cases.
Well, did I miss something in your brief? Did you have a section on all these cases that talk about substantial effect?
We do. And well,
where is it in your
brief? We have the Beauty case cited for
where
that.
Is it in your brief? I mean, it's important if this issue had been confronted by other circuits in the trademark context, which is what you seem to be telling me this morning. And it would seem to me that this is your slam dunk winner argument. And I simply didn't see it presented that way in your brief. As I say, I could have missed it.
And the substantial argument was, the Beauty case was discussed, and the pages are noted in the table of authorities, the substantiality issue.
Which page in the brief?
The Beauty case is discussed. Pages 16 and then 26 through 28. But the substantiality argument was raised in the reply brief by First Niagara Canada. So that these substantiality cases were not discussed. if you look at the reply brief...
But wait, isn't their duty to raise the substantiality argument? That's your argument.
Well, it's their duty to show that they're engaged in foreign commerce. Their argument was raised for the first time in the reply brief that all you had to do was have any amount of foreign commerce, the smallest amount would do. The Beauty case specifically discusses that. The site to that is in our brief.
And which is the Beauty case?
That's Beauty versus Perosa. It's out of the Second Circuit. Beauty versus Impresa Perosa. If you carry their argument to its logical extreme, they broker policies, for instance, municipal insurance. They broker a policy for the city of Niagara Falls, Canada. And what they say is that since people visit Niagara Falls, Canada from all over the world, those people could get injured and they could make claims. So
they may not be the strongest data point they argue. It struck me that their strongest data points were the people that are coming into the United States every day to do business, repairing plants and whatnot, driving around, carrying their insurance. And they're going to facilitate any claims that arrive with that. And also, a Clevenger, who buys a house on a lake up in Canada, needs fire insurance and theft insurance and whatnot. And so I can go directly to them and say, please get that insurance for me. And I write a check and I send it to them. It's in foreign commerce, if not interstate commerce, right? And a claim develops, the house catches on fire or something, and then there's a lot of correspondence going back and forth about the claim, right? But if that were happening between two states.
Sure, but there are
clearly, if I have a house in Colorado, right, and I have a broker here that gets me some insurance for out there, and then all of a sudden the house catches on fire or something happens to it, and I've got a lot of communication and back and forth in correspondence with the people in Colorado, I'm engaged in interstate commerce. I have to be, don't I? The insurance company that's doing that for me? The broker who's doing all this for me?
Yes, but there are a lot of cases in the trademark context that talk about the fact that just because money flows between two countries, take the Linville case that came before this court. That was a case involving beauty salons.
But can't we distinguish the Beauty case on its facts? Beauty is advertising one cafe in Milan. And here we do have letters going back and forth across the border, trucks driving in New York, a bridge insured with work on both sides of the border. And there's more than one cafe in Milan.
There was only one cafe in Milan, but in the Linville case, there were a number of beauty salons located throughout Canada. It wasn't just a single beauty salon. And in that case, there was proof that Americans were going up there, that they were going to the beauty salons. Hair care products were purchased from the United States, so money's going back and forth. Magazines are purchased in the United States. They're being transported to Canada and being used in the beauty shops, so you have magazines up there. And there was evidence in the case, I believe, of $25,000 a year of U.S. purchases at the beauty salons in Canada. This court affirmed the TTAB in that case and said that that amount of transaction between the countries was really incidental, that it was not enough, and that it did not support trademark rights for the Canadian entity. And that's what we have here.
We affirmed in Linville?
Beg pardon?
We affirmed in Linville?
Yes, you did, Your Honor.
It wasn't. Your citations don't show that. You show it as a TTAB case.
We've cited all four of the decisions in Linville and Rivard.
I'm saying Linville, TTAB, Linville, TTAB.
Yeah, if you look under Rivard, it's the same case.
Okay. All right, thank you.
The Rivard case, 1998, 133, Fed Third. 1446 is the affirmance of Linville. In one case it was Linville versus Rivard, the other case it was Rivard versus Linville. But that's the same case. And in that case, the court said that that amount of interaction between the countries, money going back and forth, that's not enough. In this case, you have a regulated Canadian brokerage firm, it would be illegal for them to do business in the United States. They don't pay taxes here. They don't have licenses here. They don't take CLE courses here. They don't do any of that here. And now they want, not having not submitted themselves to the laws of the United States and the different states, they want to come to the United States and take advantage.
The fact that they're not present, I mean, can't imagine a stockbroker in London, England, that takes orders and provides those orders to be executed on the New York Stock Exchange electronically. It happens every day. It's
yes.
As you know, it's an integrated world market. And so the London stockbroker has no office in the United States. The company's never been to the United States. And they decide they'd like to have more activity in the U.S. Stock market, so they lower their commissions well below what any American broker's charging. They don't advertise, but word gets around electronically in a hurry. And all of a sudden, in 2 days, the London broker is brokering a huge amount of transactions on the New York Stock Exchange. Never sets foot in the United States in any way whatsoever. It's just all electronic. Is that broker in London engaged in either the foreign commerce in the United States or interstate commerce?
They're not, because they would have to advertise in the United States in that situation in order to...
Why would they know? They say they don't advertise. You don't, if in the financial markets, if you're doing something good, you don't need to advertise. Word gets around in a flash.
But under the Lanham Act, you do have to advertise your services. International Bank Corp, the Fourth Circuit talked about that. They said that if you have a foreign business in that case, that was a casino...
You have to advertise your services in order to get trademark protection?
Pardon?
Here? I mean, there's no advertising in this case, is there?
There is no advertising in this case.
You say you have to advertise in order to be able to qualify as an opposer for having a mark in use?
Absolutely. We've cited the cases that say...
Which case says that?
...that you have to have advertising. Linville talks about the advertising in that case. Mother's Restaurant talks about...
You can have a situation in which you advertising is there, and maybe somebody says, because of the advertising, you're thrusting yourself into commerce or you didn't have enough advertising. Why is it a requirement?
Well, in the Linville case, in the Mother's Restaurant case, in Beauty, or in the first two at least, the court said that that advertising was insufficient, that it was just spillover advertising. In the Linville case...
How could it be? Then why did the board write 36 pages? Why didn't it write one line? No advertising, no commerce under the... I mean, the board didn't say that in any way, shape, or form, did it? The absence of advertising is dispositive in this case? Just that factor.
Well, just, not that factor alone.
Come back to my hypothetical and assume you're wrong, that you have to show that you've been advertising your mark or you've been advertising your business in order to qualify as an opposer on prior use of the mark. Assume you're wrong on that. And go back to my London broker hypothetical. Why wouldn't that person be engaged in the foreign commerce of the United States or interstate commerce?
Because they're not building brand identity in the United States. A trademark is
What happens if, with every single transaction, which is what happens, you get a paper advice that the London broker mails to you, and it says here, Dear Mr. Paul Perlman, on this day we executed this trade for and on behalf of your behalf, and it's got the name of the broker and the trademark.
Okay, well,
And so assume I have to think a million pieces of paper a day are generated that have got that on that come into the United States.
In Your Honor's hypothetical, that mark would reach the status of a well-known or a famous mark.
Well, let's say it's not a million. Let's just say it's a smaller number, but it's quite a lot. Aren't you conceding that activity of my London hypothetical London broker would satisfy the test under the trademark law?
If
being in commerce,
it might satisfy the test of providing services, but it would not. And I know it's part of your hypothetical, Your Honor, but the cases are quite clear that you need two things in order to have trademark protection or to oppose a trademark: advertising and the provision of services. And the advertising has to be in connection with the provision of services.
Any final comments, Mr. Perlman?
No, I think you have my points.
Thank you, Mr. Perlman. Would you please add 5 minutes to Mr. Gottlieb, should he need to use them, so the time will be even? Thank you.
Judge Clevenger, I think the case that you gave with the London-based broker is really exactly on point, because my colleague said advertising is required. That is not required. The statute, the Lanham Act on service mark usage, says a mark may be deemed to be used in commerce, and I'm reading from the Act, on services when it is used or displayed in the sale or advertising of services. So if it's used, that is sufficient, and if it's advertised, that is sufficient. So when our client, First Niagara Insurance, sends a premium notice to a U.S. resident asking him to pay the premium, its trademark, its trade name is right on that premium request.
And in my hypothetical, the advice that confirms the trade would be using the mark in the connection with the sale.
Right. And in addition, our client advertises on a Canadian radio station, which reaches almost a million people in the Buffalo area. And why is that important? Because people in the Buffalo area have boats on the Canadian side of the Great Lakes. So if someone in Buffalo wanted to have insurance for his boat, which is harbored on the Canadian side of the lake, and that person will know that he's going to be sailing in international waters, he'll come to us for insurance. If there's an accident on the high seas, which is covered by this insurance, there will be correspondence between our broker, my client, the Canadian company, and the U.S. resident trying to resolve this.
Mr. Gottlieb, is there a substantiality requirement for the amount of commerce that occurs across international borders as opposed to a less stringent standard for interstate commerce?
No, I've never seen a case where any substantiality standard has been placed on foreign commerce. I believe that Congress has the absolute right to cover one package of goods, one car, and Congress's power in the foreign commerce area has been said to be greater than in the interstate commerce area, because in interstate commerce there's a balance between the power of Congress and the rights of states. So I think the Supreme Court has said in some instances in interstate commerce there has to
but
be...
But maybe we're protecting domestic rights with our Domestic Trademark Act, and we're a little more concerned that we protect our domestic trademark owners and we require a little higher burden of commerce before a foreign mark owner can come in and provide opposition.
That's correct, because under the Paris Treaty, foreign trademark owners have virtually identical rights to U.S. trademark owners. In fact, a foreign trademark owner can get a registration even without use, which is something that a U.S. owner can't do. The substantiality only comes in as part of the test for interstate commerce. And in fact, there are three tests for interstate commerce. The Supreme Court has said, are the services involved in the channels of commerce or the instrumentalities of commerce, or is there an effect on commerce? And our position is that we are involved in all three. We are involved in the channels because we are involved in roads and other and air transportation. We are involved in the essence of the instrumentalities, which is the trucks that we insure.
Could I ask one other question before our time expires, and that is, if we should agree with you that that the commerce requirement allows you into this proceeding, do we still need to send it back for a finding on likelihood of confusion?
Our position is that the record is so clear on the likelihood of confusion that this court...
Board hasn't made a finding there, right?
Correct. That is correct.
So we'd need to go back for their finding.
Well, I think it is so clear on the record that the marks are identical, the services are set out in the applicant's application.
But we need something to review, and they haven't reviewed it yet, right?
But I think the court could decide it without sending it back. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Gottlieb. Our next